Hello, everybody. You're listening to The Archers, hosted by yours truly, DJ Red Viking, aka Lieutenant Blueberry. My guest today is author Elizabeth Gunn. She writes two different police procedural series, and I think she's a fantastic writer. And I would liken her to Marion C. Cooper in the sense that for people who don't know who Marion C. Cooper is, he's the guy who co-wrote, produced, and co-directed King Kong. But he's kind of like he would write these fantastical stories, but his life was almost as interesting, if not more interesting, than the people would write about. I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show.
Good afternoon.
I mean, my first question for you, because like I said, is because you've stated before that you always wanted to write. You started, like, I mean, you got kind of late into the game. You started,
yes, to say the very least, yes.
So I was wondering if you could just give us like a little summary of just like how you started.
What and, kept me?
Yeah,
why I was so late?
Yeah.
Yes, I always knew I was supposed to be a writer, but you've heard the saying that life is what happens while you're planning other activities, and that is how it occurred to me. I graduated from the University of Minnesota with a degree in English, but in order to work my way through that, the college experience, which I had to do since I had no money, I had taken every job there is to do in a hotel and a restaurant because those are easy jobs to get. So I was an experienced waitress and fry cook and front desk operator and telephone operator, which used to be a job. And then I started going to Yellowstone Park in the summer to make some easy money and have some fun and work in the hotels there. They called us savages, the people who came out from college in Minnesota and worked in Yellowstone Park. And I did that for several summers, and as I worked that job, I met a man named Phil Gunn, and by the end of the season, we drove to Idaho Falls and got married. And so he was working toward a degree in hotel administration at Cornell, and I went there with him. I had graduated by that time. And since he got the degree and I knew how to do all the jobs, my fate was kind of sealed. And we spent a whole career in the hotel business. We were lifers as innkeeper in the innkeeping trade. And we bought a couple of motels eventually in Helena, Montana, which was his hometown, and started small and built them up and raised two children in the process. So all that took up a lot of time. And when we sold the business, we had a great deal of wanderlust piled up because when you're in the innkeeping trade, when you're in the travel industry, you can't go anywhere. You're busy at home all the time. And so we took off. And we bought a sailboat and sailed it to Mexico and stayed a year and a half and came back and sold it and bought an RV and traveled all over North America. And then we parked that and went to Europe and lived there a year in Barcelona. Traveled all over Europe on Spanish bus tours and came back, did some more traveling, and ended up diving in the Florida Keys on a trawler. And it suddenly occurred to me then that time really was passing, and if I was going to be a writer, I better hurry up and start. And so that is when, on a visit home to Minnesota, I shared with my nephew, John Sibley, that I was trying to get a novel started, and I thought it was probably going to be a mystery, and I was wondering about the possibility of making it a police procedural. And he said, being the chief of police of the in Rochester at that time, he said, come on down to the station and I'll show you around. You can make up your mind if you want to write about that. And, boy, the rest is history as far as I'm concerned because I was hooked right away. Police work is really very demanding and very interesting. Policemen have wonderful stories, and they are happy to share them. Nobody wants to hear their stories, so when they find somebody who will listen, they gleefully tell you wonderful stories about things that have happened to them. And I have been listening to policemen tell their stories ever since. So I invented a character named Jake Hines, who was, and I gave him some characteristics that if you've read a few of my books, you know, he's a foundling. He's a mixed race person who doesn't know who his parents were. And so I did that on purpose because I observed that Minnesota was changing very fast, having always been demographically very, very totally white, Northern European derivation people, German and Norwegian and Swedish and Irish. All of a sudden, it was getting immigrants from all over, and it was participating fully in what is called the Browning of America, and it wasn't going to look the same way in the future as it always had when I was growing up there. And so I designed Jake Hines to be relevant in the 21st century, and that's what he is. He is a quite typical policeman of the 21st century. He probably has three or four ethnic strains in his bloodstream, and he doesn't know what they are. And he proceeds as if he did, because after all, day to day, what do any of us know? We just got to go to work and try to get the job done. And so that's what he does. And because he works hard at it and likes his job, he gets promoted from, after 5 or 6 years, from being a patrolman on the street to being a police detective. And most of the stories, I think all of the stories, he has already begun his job as a police detective. And he meets a girl who works in the, because I made several trips to the crime lab in St. Paul. The Minnesota system is built on having a big, beautiful crime lab in the Twin Cities that all the small towns can participate in, use, when they have a case that is too big or complex for the local constabulary. They take their evidence to the crime lab in St. Paul and get professionals there to analyze it. And so after I went there, I totally loved that place, so I made Jake's girlfriend be a scientist at the crime lab in St. Paul. Trudy. And eventually, in the course of the series, they get married. That's the Minnesota series, and it's still going. And then my husband and I kept traveling, and eventually, through a whole series of places that we went and things we saw, we ended up wandering across the southern end of the United States in the wintertime, and got to Tucson and said, well, the weather's nice here, isn't it? And let's stop and spend some time. And we did that and just completely fell in love with this place. In, topography, it resembles the place where we lived so long, Helena, Montana, in that it's a very pretty valley ringed by magnificent mountains. And that describes Helena also. So it sort of seemed like home, but you don't have to shovel any snow. And we thought that was a winning idea. And then we ended up buying a house here. And we've lived here. My husband, alas, has died. But we've lived here ever since. 16, 17 years, something like that. So eventually I decided that in this fascinating valley I should maybe have a crime series going, because Tucson has a lot of action. Being a border city makes it more than ordinarily interesting. But I was very dubious about my ability to get the police department in such a large, complicated city to talk to me. So I hesitated quite a while, because I was sure that they just wouldn't even want to talk to this crazy old lady that wanted to write books about all they have going on here. I could not have been more wrong. They are just as generous and helpful as the policeman in Rochester, Minnesota. I have never asked a question that no one would answer. They are all I mean, there are certain things that they can divulge and some they can't, but to the extent that they can answer me, they have always been most generous and helpful. And so when I found out what a pleasure it was to take ride-alongs in Tucson, I just went for it. And my career now is that I write every other. I have a publisher who took me on saying, we're most interested in the Tucson book, but we'll publish the Minnesota one that you say you have finished, and then we'll want the Tucson ones from now on. And after they published that first Minnesota novel, I mean the first one for them, apparently they're in Sussex, England, which is kind of a pretty rural part of England, and apparently the people there liked it too, and so they found out that they did fine with the one from Minnesota, and they said, well, I'll tell you, we'll do every other one. And so that's what we've done ever since. I don't know, what have I done with them, 6 or 7 novels. I just do one Minnesota one, and the next year I do a Tucson one. And so Jake Hines continues on in Minnesota, and Sarah Burke, who is nothing like him, continues to have a very, very interesting career in Tucson.
You first sold articles for travel magazines before you actually did any books. Do you think that made you a better writer, just doing something like that? Or did it even affect
your
writing?
Yes, I always encourage somebody who's trying to get started, because a novel's a big, demanding chunk of writing, you know? It's a daunting task to undertake. And if you haven't ever published before, and particularly if you have some age on you and you haven't published before, well, maybe there's this feeling, I haven't done it, so I know I can't. So if you start with shorter pieces that you can sell, you know, write somewhere between 2,500 and 10,000 words, put a title on it, and start sending it to the appropriate magazines and newspapers that might buy it. Before I wrote my first novel, I had a whole box the size of that full of short pieces with my byline on them. And short pieces with your byline means maybe this didn't make me rich and famous, but somebody paid good green money to publish my words. And after you've seen that for a while, you begin to believe that you can write, that you can be a professional writer, which is, you know, a long chalk ahead of being able, you know. You write a few amusing letters and your friends all say to you, oh, you should write a book, you know. Well, but come right down to it. Can I do that? That's a big step. That's a huge leap in the dark. And so short pieces are a way to start the path, start down the path. Yeah, I think it helped me a lot.
With the Sarah Burke series, because the latest book just came out, Red Man Down, from last year.
Yes.
And, I mean, because you did bring up that they are two different characters, and you kind of, like, do one book, like you do a Jake Hines book, then you do a Sarah Burke book. For you, does that always leave them, like, do you like that rhythm to it? Like, does that leave them for you fresh the next time? Because, like, do you think you would get burnt out or it would just get boring for you if you just kept doing a Jake Hines book every year?
Well, it is good in that respect, that each one gives me a rest from the other one. And in fact, I have been thinking lately that what I really need is a third series. Because, you know, you go along and you work a long time on a book. I mean, it's somewhere close to a year that you're really thinking intensively about one book. And I like both my main characters, and I don't mind spending that much time in their company. They feel like old friends to me by now. But still, there's a limit to how far I can stretch them. They're going to behave in a certain way because that's the way they're built. And so each one opens up possibilities that the other one doesn't have. And so I like the fact that I have that contrast, but I've been thinking lately that I need to refresh myself still further and try something different.
Red Man Down did come out last year, but you also have like the reprint of the first Sarah Burke book also as well. And you also have the reprint of
Well, you really know your stuff, don't you?
Yes. First Jake Hyten's book as well.
Good for you.
I mean, were those something that you thought were only going to come out like on a Kindle or something? Because
I'll tell you what happened. The first book of each series was out of print. And I go to book shows, you know. I go to interviews here and there, and I go to signings and so forth, besides the Tucson Festival of the Book. And time after time, as I was at these book festivals, and I had my little booth all set up, and I had my books all there, and I'm selling my little heart out, and that's all very well, but sooner or later somebody would always say, well, where's the first one? Because there are a certain percentage of readers, and it's quite a high percentage, who like to start a series at the very beginning and read them in order. Not everybody, but a certain number of readers, you know. And so then they will wander off mumbling, well, I'll see if I can find it on my Kindle or something, you know. Okay, and they won't buy the series till they've found that first book. So I talked and talked to each of my publishers in an effort to get the first one reprinted, but they felt they sold, you know, they got the most they could get out of it, and they weren't enthusiastic at all about the idea of a reprint. So enough time went by so that in my contract it says that after a certain number of years, and if it's been out of print for a certain amount of time, I get the rights back. You have to really go after that, though, because they're not going to really voluntarily rush up to you and say, here, Elizabeth, here's your book back. They like to kind of keep them tucked in a drawer in case something, you know, lightning should strike and you sell one to TV or something, you know. But if you insist, well, you know, it's right there in the contract, so you can get it back. And that's what I did. In the case of each of those two books, I got the rights back. And then I went and became a self-published author for the first time. Amazon has a print service. You probably know this. It's called, what is it called? I don't know. It's got a name. And they will do print on demand. Fortunately for me, my daughter is a computer programmer, and she has a shop in Sheridan, Wyoming. She took them into her shop and set them all up with the format that they want for their books, and we got them reprinted. And so I have the first, at last, I have the first copy of the Jake novels and the Sarah novels.
First name of the Sarah novels is Cool in Tucson.
Yes.
When you got it reprinted and you're looking back on it, because I do want to ask you something, because one of your friends, Jam Hayes, who's also a writer, he reprinted his first novel, The Great Pilgrim.
Yes.
But he did a little bit of editing to it.
Yes, he changed some things by the time he was getting it done, and he didn't do the printing himself as I did. He got his then publisher, Poison Pen Press, to print it. But he had rethought some things, I guess, and so I guess he made a few changes.
I mean, just for yourself, was that something you would ever consider doing, or once the book's out and you can't do anything about it?
Yeah, I didn't have anything I wanted to change. I pretty much, that's where I set up the characters, and the rest of the series followed from that. So I was content with what I had, but the format has to be the mysterious world of cyber, this and that, you know, that I don't understand it all, but my daughter fortunately does, and her staff. So it has to be set in a certain way so that it comes out looking right and paginated correctly and so forth. And they did all that. Also, you have to get new cover art because you have a right to the words back, but you don't have a right to the art. And so they had to do that for me, get new covers.
I mean, because you did bring up that you're thinking about a third series. Would a third series still be a mystery novel? Are you thinking of doing something completely different, like out of your wheelhouse that not a lot of people would see coming?
I'm kind of hooked on the idea of a mystery. For one thing, it's what people expect from me. But for another thing, I think I like the form. You know, you write a book, it's like building a house. You pour the footings, you know, you put in the the uprights, and then you hang the walls on that, and it's got a certain form that once it's designed, you just follow that form, and that feels natural to me now. I don't always know exactly what vile crime is going to be perpetrated, but I know that there's going to be one, you know, and I hang the story around all the things that will have to be done because of that. And there's just a certain comfort level that I get from having that format going for me. So, yeah, I did once, I will share with you, write the Great American Novel. Once when I lost my publisher and I was at loose ends and didn't know if there was going to be a future for my series, I said, okay, I'll quit writing mysteries and I'll be a literary novelist from now on. And I spent 2 years writing what I thought was a very, very good novel, and it is still safe and warm in the drawer at home. I have never been able to sell it.
I mean, because you did do an interview with GM Hayes where you kind of talked about like that you did have it like in your drawer. Is it something that you go back to, or do you keep
he
working
and I
on
share that? You know, he's got one too. We have it as a, you know, the goad in our side that we spent a lot of time writing a book that we desperately wanted to have, you know, be our ticket to the big time, and that we've never sold it. And it appears that we have to swallow the information that that's not us. We're not that. We don't do that. We do this other thing. Who can say? But I would have sold it if I could have. I still would if somebody would buy it.
Have you used anything from your research for that book in any of your other books?
No, not so far. No. It was unique. And I've created a couple of characters for that book that I really, really liked. But they're just my buddies at home. I can't sell them.
Do you think you'll ever get it sold?
You know, I don't think I'll ever give up trying. I like it too much. Every so often I take it out and rethink it. I think I've rewritten it about 5 times. We'll see.
With the characters of Jake Hines and Sarah Burke, because they are so polar opposite from one another, is any of your personality in any of those characters?
Some and all of them, including the villains.
Would you say Jake or Sarah's more like you than the other one, or you think it's equal?
I think Jake is more like guys I know, a lot of guys. I think Jake is kind of pretty close to a compendium of several male persons in my family, and that is why I know him so well. He feels so familiar to me. I think that's what I built him from, is what I knew about Minnesota guys from the guys in my family. Sarah, you see, a lot of years had gone by. When I started writing Jake Hines, in Minnesota there were no female police detectives. In fact, they were only just beginning to hire street patrol persons from the female persuasion. Minnesota's a pretty conservative state, and Heartland, USA, and you know, it lagged behind places like LA and New York in that respect. So I had no paradigms to follow for a female police detective in Minnesota. So that was never in any doubt to me that I was going to, you know, have a male police detective. But by the time I got to Tucson, heck, some crews that go to the graduation down there that's in Red Man Down, some of those crews are almost 50% female now. Women make very good cops, it turns out. And it's a good job that they're glad to have. And so a lot of them apply. And that's a whole new thing in the last 20 years. So by the time I started in Tucson, I had women I could go talk to in the police department about, you know, and boy, did they bring me up short when I asked dumb questions like, "Are you ever afraid?" The short answer is I've got, how'd you say this? I've got a wand, a pepper spray, a taser, and a Glock 9. No, I'm not afraid. They are very, very well trained. And they get exactly the same training as their male counterparts. And they are nothing daunted. They experience exactly the same fears that the men do, but no more. And they feel, they have expressed it to me, they feel that in some respects they do have an advantage because their approach is somewhat softer, so they have a tendency, they find it a little bit easier to calm a situation down and not have to use force. They're quite proud of that. So it was interesting to change to a female protagonist. She does not do things exactly the way Jake does them. But she's there to do her job the same way as he is. She has a somewhat more, this is the other thing, is that society has whirled right along. And so Sarah has a somewhat more troubled and churned up personal life than Jake. Of course, Jake got very, very lucky when he found Trudy. He had his divorce behind him, and he fell in love with a very capable woman who was very taken with him. So I gave him a quite idyllic marriage. Maybe a little too. But it was, I just kind of wanted him to be happy. I like Jake a lot.
I mean, because you did bring up the personal lives, and that's something that I find very interesting, especially just in police procedurals, because normally, especially like the bad ones, or it doesn't even have to be bad, but it's pretty much just the case.
And yes, yes.
They don't ever go into the guy's actual personal life, especially with Sarah. I mean, from your own research, how do you find that? Because, like, I'm just interested in how the officers who have now, in Sarah's case, she does have a relationship with somebody that's also a police detective, so there's a little bit of that understanding where they know how crazy the case could get. Yeah. But, like, from the cops that you've interviewed, I'm just interested in, like, how they're able to, like, maintain a relationship given the kind of job that they're in.
Exactly. And I thought that was one of the most interesting facets of police work that I really wanted to write about, is that very, very difficult transition that they have to make every day when they take off the uniform and go home and take out the garbage or take the kids to PTA or whatever. I personally would find that extremely difficult. And I have asked just about everyone that I have ridden with, you know, how is that transition for you? How do you... And I will share this with you. They are all concerned to a man and woman, just about. They have expressed concern over the high divorce rate in police departments. And they don't even want to talk about the high suicide rate from retired cops. I mean, it is a high-stress job. It is a very demanding job, and I thought that the most successful, comfortable, happy-seeming ones that I rode with and that told me about their life all mentioned quite contented, you know, happy marriages and children. That was kind of their fallback, their sponge, their bouncing. Their bounce, that they had a good home life that supported their emotional well-being, and that gave them the energy to go out and do this difficult job every day. And so I don't see it. I would not enjoy writing anyway. The ones who write, you know, the loner on the mean streets. I don't think it's quite realistic in the first place. And I don't see anything to admire about being lonely and driven and so on. Who, I mean, if you come right down to it, who wants that really? Cop or no cop, everybody wants and needs a decent home life. And so I give that to my cops. But there's no getting around the fact that sometimes the job interferes with that really to an extreme extent. I mean, they work 24-hour days sometimes when the job demands it. They get into situations that are very emotionally taxing. And I think when they go home, sometimes they need a little space. My initial source, my cop, John Sibley, the guy who got me started, he and his wife both have talked to me about this, about the fact that it's not easy to live with a cop. If you're gonna have a wife in there, she better be a patient wife, because there are gonna be bad days. And as for whining kids, well, you know, when the nerves are already shredded, it's not so easy. But I think it's the interesting part to write about. The fact that, after all, come right down to it, these are just human beings that have to do this very, very difficult job. Mm-hmm. And that gives a writer something to write about. You know, that's interesting.
I mean, we're talking about, like, the characters' personal lives, and you have stated before that you kind of like, the characters that you like to write the most about are villains. You've kind of stated that before. For you, what makes a good villain and what makes an interesting villain to you? And do you think a story can have an all right hero, but the villain's got to be good? Like, if the villain's good, the story will be fine.
Yeah. I will share with you that it's a lot more fun to write villains than good guys. Because bad guys are guys who have thrown off some of the constraints and allow themselves behavior that isn't available to you and me. You know? And in this last book that's at the publisher now that will be out in this summer, Jake Hines has a moment when he remembers that he spent a period of his childhood after they took him away from his foster mother, whom he loved, that he spent a period of several years being a brat, being a troubled preteen, and getting in fights and looking for a fight because he was mad. He was angry. He was disgusted. He was against the system because the system had, in his view, wrecked his life. And so he did a lot of, he did as many, he was working his way up to be a thug, is how he puts it. You know, he was making his run to learn how to be a thug. And he was saved from that fate by a couple of extremely skillful and imaginative teachers. But he said, I sometimes do remember, though, how much fun it was to indulge in bad behavior. And then he gives a couple of examples of things he used to do. And that is why it's more fun to write villains, is because you can have them do sudden, surprising things. That's what they get their fun from, you know, is scaring the pants off somebody, or, you know, tearing the situation up, or kicking the room apart, or indulging their whims. They have very poor, I mean, the whole thing is they have very poor emotional control, usually because of very bad childhoods, they have not developed proper emotional control, and so they're subject to whims. And when they get one, they just as soon set fire to the room. So for a writer, their possibilities are endless. You know, you can have them do just about anything that you need them to do to move the story along.
I mean, with the Jake Hines series and the Sarah Burke series, do you ever see an end for them? And how do you kind of Like, do you ever see an end to either of those series? And how do you kind of keep, like, how do you kind of keep, like, complacency control? Like, you don't want to just kind of end up, like, eating your tail. Like, you just, it just becomes parody at a certain point. Like, oh, I got to keep ratcheting things.
You mean, how do you keep it from turning it into a big yawn?
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not so easy. You just gotta keep turning over rocks. You just gotta read everything, talk to everybody, read papers all the time. The paper's full of good stuff. It isn't just the crimes, but the way society as a whole looks at itself and reacts to things, I don't know if you've noticed, but it's changing. It's changing. I mean, we used to have a lot of people talking about the grave danger to our society is godless communism. And you don't hear that anymore because now the grave danger to our society are Muslims who want to wreck us, you know, who want to kill us. And there's fads. Times change. Crimes change. And people's reactions to each other change with it and so on. And then patriarchs don't exercise the same control over their families that they used to. Mainly because a lot of patriarchs don't stick around anymore. So times change, and you gotta. There's plenty of change to keep you occupied, but you gotta keep your eyes open and not. You're right. It would be. You have to watch out for complacency.
One of the aspects that I like a lot about the Sarah Burke novels is just, I just think it's cool that when you read it, you're actually talking about places here in Tucson. So there's just kind of like that. It's just kind of like, well, it's here. Like, you know, it's different because typically if you're reading a detective novel, depending where it might be, like, you know, like New York City or something, which, I mean, it doesn't say anything about the merit of the novel. I mean, it can be good or bad, but there's just something, like, there's an extra layer there just because you're using actual places here.
Yeah, corners that you know.
All the places that you bring up are those places you actually been to and stuff.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And
that's,
like,
the only way you can do it. You got to go there and really hang out. Yeah.
I mean, has there been any places, like, I mean, just with your research alone, has there been anything, like, has there been anything, especially because it is, like, the border and stuff like that, has there been anything that was trouble to you to gain access to that you wanted to get some information about?
Well, the hardest one to gain access to was Border Patrol, because they're under so much fire all the time that they're very cautious about sharing. And who can blame them? Because, we want them to do it, but we haven't made up our mind how. And there's so much conflict in the society about how everybody feels about that border. Some people want it sealed shut and don't ever, you know, throw the key away. And then other people want to be much more neighborly than we are being, and feel that we could work out a few things if we would do that, you know. And there's all this conflict about watering stations in the desert for the people who decide. And, you know, God, it doesn't have easy answers. It doesn't. I'm sure it's not up to me to decide it. And so there's a lot of conflict in that, and that all devolves upon the guys in the blue suits that have to carry out the orders. But then, let's not get feeling too sorry for them. My, they have a great deal of shiny, good equipment down there in that. Have you ever been to that station down there that's a few miles from the border? They have got automotive equipment as far as the eye can see. And you look at it and you think, God, for what we're spending here, we could do something useful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of conflict about it, and so they just assume not talk to outsiders. And they did, however, after I showed considerable persistence and found one or two friendly faces, they did give me a ride along that border fence and show me what was, you know, what worked and what didn't work from their point of view. What their biggest problems were, and so on and so on. Any information that they give you down there is just about good for the season they give it in. You got to hurry up and put it in the book. Because, you know, that's the other thing, is their life is constant, you know, their orders are constantly changing as the policy changes. So that was hard to write about. You almost feel like, maybe I'm walking on eggs here. Maybe I don't want to write this at all. But it was so interesting, I couldn't resist it, so I went ahead and did it.
Yeah. I mean, when you're doing something like a situation where it's kind of like eggshells like that, do you ever try to just say, okay, I'm going to portray? Because it's, I mean, I'm pretty sure if you hear two sides of a story, normally the truth's in the middle somewhere. Because they're only showing you the best. I'm sure the people crossing the border have a different
story.
But
the middle gets kind of bland, you know, so it's more interesting to present both sides. Because that's where all the fire and heat is. Yeah. So you being a writer is not an easy task, but you have to weigh and sort that way, you know. What makes the best sentences? What makes a book worth reading? And obviously, presenting the truth insofar as you are able to perceive it in a colorful and interesting way, that's your task. And so you got to be brave sometimes and just go ahead and, but not present your own point of view. That's the one you got to watch out for. Except that I suppose just the story you decide to tell probably reveals something about your point of view, sure. But I mean, you really got to stay off the soapbox about all these things, because there are a lot of soapboxes out there to climb onto.
We did bring up the Tucson Festival of Books earlier on during this interview. I know you're going to be there. For people that have never gone to the Tucson Festival of Books,
I have been in every one so far, and I've got good slots in this one.
So,
the Tucson Festival of Books is the best thing that has ever happened to writers in this area by about a country mile. It is a blessing. It is just, I cannot tell you how grateful I am to the people who decided to start it. It's a fantastic success. It's only been going 6 years. This will be the seventh one. And it's already, the fourth largest in the country? I mean, we're talking big cities like L.A. and New York, you know. It's a huge success. It astonishes everybody, including the people who, the founding fathers, how fast it became a huge success. Part of it is the campus is beautiful. It's the perfect setting for a book festival. It looks the part, you know. And the weather, except for one horrid day when we sold books in the rain. I still can't believe we found a way to do that. But except for that one day, it's always been beautiful weather. It was so smart of the organizers to include a lot of stuff for kids, because that brings whole families to it. And the kids are just a joy. Everybody just loves watching them. You know, and that brings, so then they bring, you know, they've got their clowns and the bands and the balloons and fun stuff, you know, gives it a carnival atmosphere. And yet they've done a darn good job of getting serious nonfiction writers to come to it. They got a lot of academics involved. They try to be a little bit trendy. They get graphic novelists and so forth and so forth. You know, it just they just really try to cover the waterfront, and they've done a wonderful job with mystery writers. I can't tell you how pleased we are. I mean, for one thing, they put Sarah Burke, who runs Clues Unlimited. They let her assign the chores on that end of the festival. And naturally, she knows who's writing mystery books and who's reading them and what people are interested in right now and so on. Which panels will pose the interesting questions and answers and so on. And so she does a very, very good job of that. It's a whopping big job. So we're all sucking up to her, believe me. Rightly so, because she, you know, she does a wonderful job for us. And it's just great exposure for writers like me, especially who are not you know, we're not on the level of John Grisham. We're not up there. We sell everything we write, but we're not huge, most of us around here. But yet, there we are sitting on panels with the likes of Elmore Leonard. Yeah, it's pretty thrilling.
Just to deviate a little bit from writing, because I just want to ask you this because I think it's interesting, because you were in Berlin during the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was just wondering if you could just talk about what that experience was like.
What it was like?
Yeah, like what that experience was like.
It was thrilling. And then, of course, part of the thrill was that there was no way you could plan that. Nobody knew it was going to happen. We were just strolling around Barcelona. We decided to spend a year in Barcelona and travel Europe from there. Barcelona because, same reason we came to Tucson, it was the southern part of Europe, and we knew we wanted to stay a whole year, so we thought we'd get where the winter wouldn't be too bad. You know, you didn't have to take so many clothes. So, and besides, Barcelona's a port city, and we like those. Okay. So we were in Barcelona strolling around, and suddenly we noticed that the newspaper kiosks were getting all the action. Everybody was clustered around, talking excitedly, right? So we went over to see what it was all about, and whereas our spoken Spanish was not perfect, I could read newspapers in Spanish from, like, the second month I was there. We took Spanish in school, but it doesn't stay with you. And we spent a year and a half in Mexico on a boat, but again, you only speak when you got something wrong with the boat or you need to go in a shop and order something. So, but I could read the newspaper almost from the beginning. Newspapers are quite predictable in the way they use language, for one thing, so, you know, you kind of get used to that. Anyway, I could see that the wall had been breached and was coming down. And that's what everybody was so excited about. Well, it was, you're too young to understand, but it was, you know, a given with us that there were two sides to Europe now. There were two Berlin, there were two Berlins, there were two Germanys. It had been that way ever since the end of World War II, because the four powers made this agreement in order to get the war stopped. They made an agreement as to who would have control over certain zones of influence. And of course, the Russians had fought, you know, they fought for years and years almost unaided before the Allies really got their shit together, quite frankly. And so they demanded a lot, and they got it because, you know, they'd earned it. And so when the war ended, they sealed that off and said, we're never going to have people come across this space at us again with big armies. And so they just shielded themselves with countries. And those people got left behind. They just got stuck over there. They didn't have a choice. But suddenly, the countries around them got sick of the game and started opening their borders. That's what did it. And the people in East Germany noticed that they could go to, you know, they could go south and go to a couple other countries and go around the wall. They didn't have to go over it. And so suddenly there was a big parade of cars going around the south end. And the Russians said, oh, the hell with it, and opened the wall. And that's when they brought their sledgehammers and started knocking it down. God, it was quite a picture. It was really something to see. People were so thrilled, and they hadn't calculated the cost yet, which was considerable, of rebuilding East Germany. But they were, you know, people were seeing their grandchildren for the first time and stuff like that, you know. There were people at the wall crying, kissing, hugging, holding babies. It was a real emotional fest. And we just got to stand around and watch. Because we said, as soon as we saw what was happening, we said, put us on the next bus tour to Berlin. And we went and watched. It was a thrilling thing, a part of the year that we never could have asked for. Didn't know it was going to happen.
Who are some writers, who are just some writers you're reading, or who are some writers that you feel their best work is still ahead of them?
Best work still ahead of them?
Still ahead of them.
Boy, I'd like to think I'm one of those. But I'm not sure. I'm getting kind of long in the tooth. But then Mike feels the same way, that we've been writing for quite a while. And so we've written long enough now so that we're genuinely ambitious and want each book to be better than the last and think hard about what we want to achieve. Let's see. There's a woman who teaches English, teaches writing mostly to people who have English as a second language, because at the university, her name is Diane, D.L. What's her last name? But if I were you, I'd get to know her. She's a comer. She's only written, I think, two novels so far. But she's writing quite steadily now, and she gives every sign of intending to be ambitious and really go for it. I think you will be hearing more and more about her. Diane, what is her last name? And now I'm embarrassed. I know her real well. She's a friend of mine. I can't say her last name today. There is another one up in Oracle named Priscilla. Boy, last names are bad for me today. She's a good writer, and she's going to get better. She's ambitious too. She was doing ghostwriting for the money for quite a while. She recently started writing her own stuff. And she's struggling, but I think she'll make it. She has a lot of life experience and good attitudes and stuff. I think she'll do some interesting things. Susan Cummins Miller, do you know her?
No.
You should interview her. She has a series about. It's interesting. By profession, she's a geologist. And her protagonist is a geologist. So she puts her stories in the Southwest, but unlike those of us who have set up Tucson series, she can take her geologist anywhere, you know, anywhere there's a mountain or an interesting block of stones in the Southwest. And so she has a lot of variety in her stories, and a lot of, surprisingly, one of the things about it is, it's one of the things I like best about it, I, who know nothing about geology, find the parts that she puts in about geology just fascinating. So she does a good job on that. Susan Cummins Miller. She has a series of maybe six or seven books. They have names like Quarry, and the one that's coming out this year is about the Grand Canyon. I think it's her best one yet. It's about, you know, the fact that you can sit in the Grand Canyon and see the ages that the Earth has gone through. I never thought of it that way before, but that's what you're looking at. The water has dug down through the ages of the planet. So if you're a geologist and you know what those stones mean, you can look at that and tell people the history of the planet. I'll tell you, one of the surprising ones that seems to be suddenly raising his game a little bit is John Grisham. He has always sold very, very well, been a famous, successful writer. But lately he seems to have gotten ambitious to make his stories a little more complicated and interesting. C.J. Box is a very good writer. You know his stuff at all?
No, I don't know C.J. Box.
He's from Wyoming. The other one who's from Wyoming is Craig Johnson, who writes that series he sold to TV. Longmire.
Oh, Longmire, okay.
Yeah, he's got a series of books about Longmire. Both of them are very, very good writers with books that are fun to read.
As a writer, what's the highest compliment you can receive?
What's the highest compliment?
Yes, as a writer.
I like to hear that people enjoyed reading my books. I got a letter from one I love to get a little one-page written on lined paper like this letter from somebody who obviously never writes fan letters. I got one once from a guy who said, I work the night shift in the post office at some little town way up in Maine, and I want to thank you for the nights that you've helped me get through the shift. And I got one like that, very much like that, just lately, and I got to tell you, they really make my day. When you feel as if you reached out and touched somebody that you're never going to meet, way off in some little dinky town in some remote part of the country, who thought enough about your book to write you some kind of a little note about it and say that he likes it. Well, you know, wow, that, it's not money, but still, it's a big compensation. It really is. I like it a lot.
For people interested in your work, would like to learn more about you or like the Tucson Festival of Books, and I know you're also associated with, and forgive me because I think I might have its name wrong, like I think it's the Arizona Mystery Writers Association or something, like anybody that's interested in any of that, where can they go?
Where can they go?
Yeah, to find out about your work or about.
Well, I'm a member of Sisters in Crime, which has a local chapter here. That's a national organization. And I'm a member of Arizona Mystery Writers, which is a local chapter, but it's not affiliated with the National American Mystery Writers. It just is. They don't want to pay any national dues, so this is just a group of 25 or 30 local writers who have a chapter here and meet every month. And both of them are full of strivers, people who are constantly trying to improve their writing. And they both bring interesting talkers, interesting people with interesting careers in law enforcement somewhere to talk to us. We get a lot out of that, you know. Like they're sheriffs or they're chemists who work in the crime lab or they're we get interesting guys from the university who know everything there is to know about the bugs you find on dead bodies, you know, or some obscure little, you know, corner of the law like that of the forensics that are fun to listen to and bring you wonderful tidbits and tell you books you can read to get more stuff like that and so on.
And before we go, is there anybody you'd like to thank who's either supported you throughout your career or who has been instrumental to your career?
Oh, my husband. He's gone now, but he was marvelous to me and most patient about not just helping to get me places and on time and so forth, and driving me around the country and everything. But he was always my first reader, and he did not hesitate to tell me when I had something wrong, but always in the most tactful way. And he was just considering that we went through, you know, what most people would consider a long marriage before I ever started this. He was just wonderfully supportive about this crazy notion I took to suddenly start writing books.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because I've talked to like a few male writers who actually have wives, and they say like they actually like admire the wife a lot because it's hard living with a writer. And you also, I mean, we did kind of talk a little bit about just kind of like the difficulties just with like not to say it's the same thing like with police and the relationship, but I mean, do you think if you are in a relationship and you are going to try to be a writer, that that's something you should tell your significant other about? Like, do you think at times it can be kind of stressful for both people involved in the relationship if somebody's going to say, I want to become a writer in the relationship?
You probably should confess it early on. Yeah, if you're going to stick with it because, A, it's going to mean that you have to have something else for a day job for a long time in the future. Nobody, unless you strike gold, you know, amazingly fast. Most people do not make a living out of this for the first, who knows, quite a few years that they're doing it. And even after you get, as I have, you know, two series going, and I do sell everything I write, still, I do not really make enough to live on. If I didn't have the income that I already have, I would have to do that plus something else, you know, in order to live comfortably. So it's a very demanding life that that is not financially very rewarding for very many people. There's a tiny, you know, you talk about the 5%, well, it's 5% or less in the writing field that ever make it big enough to be really, really comfortable on what they make. So yes, if you intend to follow that lifestyle, and you are in or wish to formulate a liaison with somebody who's going to hitch her wagon to your star, it would probably be a good idea to discuss it first, because it leaves your partner. It was different for us because, after all, we'd lived together for a long time. So in that much time, you develop hours of the day when you expect to be left to your own devices. Everybody does who occupies the same domicile. You know, this is my time to read. This is my nap time. This is my whatever. This is when I go do my chess club or whatever. You know, married people, after a certain amount of time, they give each other a lot of leaving alone time. But when you're first married, you don't. You expect to be together a lot, and that's not good for writing. You've got to have a lot of time for it. You've got to ask a lot of yourself. So it isn't only your significant other you want to talk to it about. You want to think hard about it yourself. You know, do I really want to devote all these hours to this not very rewarding task? The only thing is, it really beats everything else in town. You see, I mean, if you like it, if it tickles your imagination and you like it, well, then there's nothing else that even compares with it. I can't imagine what I'd be doing with my life if I weren't writing books.